I'm flooded with cookbooks right now who are written by people who don't know how to cook. Seriously. I mean, I've had publishers who have told me that if you don't have at least 500,000 followers, they don't even want to talk to you. We have people writing books based on fad. And it's just not my, it's not my thing.
Hey everyone, I'm Dan Bova, writer and editor at Entrepreneur.com, and welcome to How Success Happens, the show where I talk to people with a fierce hunger to do big things and make the world a better place, like today's guest, Andrew Zimmern. He is an award-winning chef, producer, and author who many of us got to know while watching him eat rather interesting and sometimes horrifying cuisines on his show, Bizarre Foods. Andrew is a global ambassador to the United Nations World Food Program and produced the three-part docuseries Hope in the Water. And now he's turned those learnings from that experience into a new cookbook, The Blue Food Cookbook, Delicious Recipes for a Sustainable Future. So we're going to talk about the book, how we can be more responsible eaters here on planet Earth, and get into some mouthwatering recipes, which honestly are going to kill me because I skipped breakfast and I am starving. Welcome, Andrew.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for being here. For those who are watching this, how about that background of Andrew? There's a lot going on there. We got big fish. We got guitars, flags.
Good yeah, stuff. This is Union Army Civil War flag from Gettysburg.
Wow.
Yeah, I got a lot of, you know, my office is a pretty cool space. We have a lot of things all around here. Some people need to be in a very sterile environment.
Yeah.
We have other people who office in rooms that are just all white. There's nothing in them. I like to be surrounded by my stuff. It keeps me creative. It keeps me thinking about new things.
Yeah.
I have an entire wall over here that's just, you can actually write on the wall. And I also have like giant post-it notes, the, you know, that are 4 feet by 2.5 feet. So yeah. A lot going on.
Andrew, you're a man after my own heart. As I got a bunch of junk in the background. I got things written all over the place. I, too, like a little bit of chaos to get me going. So like-minded people. So you've done so many things over the years, as evidenced by all these treasures behind you. And your career has evolved so much. And I'm wondering, has your personal definition of success evolved as well from when you started to how you think of success today?
Oh, sure. Completely shifted 360 degrees. Earlier in my career, in my 30s, everything was about me. It was about getting things. It was about deals. It was about how bright can your star shine. It was about you know money. Now it is literally the exact opposite. It is about other people. It is about experiences, not things. It's about where I can be additive, not where I can be subtractive. It's about prioritizing happiness in my life and not success as measured by how most people do. And I hope I wind up with something to retire on at some point. I mean, but it's not the driver. It's I've let go of that need, and that comes ping ponging back and forth depending on the day. I mean,
yeah.
you reach a certain age in life and you say, okay, based on the average American lives to age 75, right?
Mm-hmm.
How many more years will I be working? What will I be doing? Will I be able to provide for my family when I'm gone, and on right. and on and on. So, I mean, you do have those questions keep popping up. And, yeah, we'll see. That final, check back with me in 5 years. I'll let you know how it's going.
Okay. Was that, I mean, you mentioned that it is a ping pong, and I think a lot of us can relate to that. One day you're feeling this way, and then the other day you're panicked, and you're like, I have to hold on to everything.
Well, it's really easy to be spiritual and other-centered in a foxhole.
Right. It's true.
You know? God, get me out of this,
right.
and I will be your greatest soldier. You know,
right.
I mean, that is the, you know, the cliche.
Yeah.
So when things are absolutely gone to total shit, it's really easy to let go and become a spiritual giant.
Right.
It's conversely, I think it's very easy when, you know, the love of your life says, yes, I'll marry you. And the phone rings and the big deal lands that you believe will have you set for the rest of your life. And the dog comes running back in the door. Really easy to be a spiritual giant then as well. Everywhere in between, we are human beings. Our moods, life is fired at point blank range. I mean, the phone calls, the deal comes in, the phone calls and your child is sick in the hospital. The phone calls and a parent has died. The phone calls and, you know, your business partner says, I'm going to India and joining an ashram. I mean, you cannot predict from one minute to the other. And as an entrepreneur and as someone who is trying to be successful by my new definition of terms, you try to meet calamity with some form of serenity. And to do that, it requires practice. That's why it's called a spiritual practice, because you're doing it every day. And you try to be as level as you can throughout the day and not be, you know, jumping up and down like an EKG looks when it prints out.
That's right.
And that's very difficult. But,
yeah.
You know, the longer that you're at it, the easier it becomes. And I just try to not let the highs. I guess you learn the highs don't mean you're set. And the lows don't mean it's over. And so you learn through experience. I think that's why everybody says when they're 40 or 50, boy, I wish I was 20 and knew now what I, mm-hmm. what I knew then, what I know now.
Yeah.
That's an impossibility. The point of life is to actually go through it and see what your journey is.
Right, right, right. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. It's an amazing viewpoint. It's one I know I struggle with. I'm like, just calm down.
Does. I mean, that's the beauty of this. The beauty of this is that, I mean, the people who don't readily talk about it, I think the ones that just haven't figured out a way to express it or won't admit it. Because everyone at a point in their life, let's say north of 45 or 40 or 50, whatever it is, different for everyone. But at some point we have this common moment where we've had enough life experience that we have abandoned the folly of our youth and we are in a more mature phase of our life when we can try to understand with greater clarity day by day what's actually going on.
Right, right. Absolutely.
And there's by the way, the appearance versus the reality. Right?
Yeah.
The appearance is the deal comes through. There's a big number assigned to it, all the rest of the kind of stuff. I've made it. Touchdown. The reality is it can get wiped off the face of the earth in a day. I'll tell you an interesting story that illustrates that with me. You know, I had a bunch of TV shows that were hits and it, the biggest one being Bizarre Foods, and Travel Channel decided in 2018 or whatever to turn from a travel and food network to a ghost and paranormal network.
Right.
And they became Tervil. They had a vowel movement. You know, I wasn't going to try to search for Bigfoot and have dinner with him. That wasn't so. I had a year and a half left on my contract. They bought it out. And then I made a show that I had been pitching to MSNBC for 8-9 years called What's Eating America. And What's Eating America told stories about civics and history through food. And I had been pushing MSNBC for a decade to match what CNN was doing on Sunday nights with their non-news programming, where they had explorers and journalists with a small J and some comedians and my friend, the late, great Tony Bourdain, doing shows that were fantastic. And eventually they said, fine, make this show. They made it a 6-part limited series. The ratings for episode 1 were off the charts. It grew in episode 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It did something extremely rare in television. You very rarely see a fully uphill bar graph in terms of ratings. And it was the highest rated show they had ever done.
Wow.
That wasn't like an interview with a president or, you know, one of, you know, the news format shows, right?
Yeah.
And it was a huge victory. It premiered in the middle of February 2020. So by the time the 6-week run was over, they were going full wall-to-wall COVID. Literally, our show aired on Sunday nights. That Monday was the explosion mm-hmm. of COVID on television. I went from jumping up and down because I thought that was the job that I was going to be doing for the next 20 years of my life, and I would be the next Charles Kuralt, famously created On the Road for CBS and did that his, you know, the last 20 years of his career. And that's what, that was my goal. So I got my wish, but then a global tragedy took it all off the table. And by the time everything steadied out again, all the people involved with the show, all the executives, the head of Comcast, who owned NBC, everyone was new. No one wants to take the old show. It took me a long time to let go of what happened there. But my point, going back to the earlier part of the conversation, is you can get everything you want on a silver platter, and 30 seconds later, a second later, it's gone. Life is fired at point blank range. So my advice to anyone is to learn how to equalize in life.
Yeah. Wow. That is a heartbreaker, man. As I said at the top here during your introduction, you have been very focused on our oceans and ocean life. And you've talked about how food systems are broken, but you believe that blue foods are a fix. So can you talk a little bit about that and also just what drew you to this part of the environment and the food chain?
Well, I've always been involved in it. You know, 20 years ago when people said, oh, you're, you know, at that point, my TV career was not what it became. It was about to begin. And, you know, what do you specialize in cooking? I've always cooked seafood. That's always been my thing.
As we've seen on this show, all kinds of people can find success. Did you know that 34% of tech professionals don't have a bachelor's degree? Skills First Hiring isn't just inclusive, it is the smart strategy to expand your tech talent pipeline. And finding the right tech talent isn't just hard, it's mission critical. And yet many enterprise employers still rely on outdated methods or platforms that just don't deliver. In today's market, hiring tech professionals isn't just about filling roles. It's about outpacing competitors. But with niche skills, hybrid preferences, and high salary expectations, it's never been more challenging to cut through the noise and connect with the right people. And that's where Indeed comes in. Indeed isn't just a job board, it is your tech hiring partner. As a number one site where tech talent applies to jobs, Indeed gives you direct access to over 3 million U.S. tech professionals, 86% of whom have applied through the platform. So post your first job and get $75 off at Indeed.com/tech talent. That's Indeed.com/tech talent to claim this offer. Indeed, built for what's now and what's next in tech hiring.
I, as a little kid growing up on the East Coast, learned from my parents how the ocean systems work. My mother wrote books about shells. My father was a fisherman and outdoors person on the water. And I was really aware of what was happening, even at an early age in the 60s and 70s, to our climate, our oceans, which at the time we were just pitching garbage into and destroying. I lived through the 70s and 80s and the establishment of, you know, Clean Air, Clean Water Acts, all the things that, you know, we did to try to bridge that gap. And I'm cooking and learning. And as a chef, you stand in the middle of your restaurant and you come face to face every day with hunger and food waste and climate crisis and immigration issues and environmental issues and gender equity issues and healthcare and pay equity and, you know, insurance. I mean, you deal with this every single day, which is why there's so many great chef advocates out there for all kinds of big issues. My focus was always on seafood. And about 14 years ago, someone sent me a farmed salmon, which I had really no interest in eating. And the reason was is that farm salmon previous to that experience was always pretty crappy compared to waiting for the spring and the summer for the four big species of salmon to run starting in May, ending in August. And I didn't want to support something that had a 10-to-1 feed ratio, you know, where it took 10 pounds of food to produce 1 pound of fish.
Oh, wow.
The fish were living in overcrowded pens. Right. Copper nettings were being used that were damaging the water. And the salmon that arrived at my door was actually pretty darn good. I subsequently got interested in, over the next 2 or 3 years, aquaculture, when it came to ocean-going fish, especially salmon, food went to 1-to-1, no copper netting. And I got really activated by this idea of aquaculture as a global food solution, because I was also interested in hunger issues. And, you know, it seemed like aquaculture was net positive for jobs, for immigration issues, for hunger, for helping our climate, for feeding an increasingly hungry planet. I realized, oh my gosh, aquaculture is an amazing thing that more people need to be talking about and investing in. And I started to investigate it, and I spent the last 10 years of my life really focused on that. And by the way, doing better for the planet isn't left or right or red or blue. We all want to do better for our communities, however we define them, right? So we just put the facts out there. And by the way, if you're right-leaning and you're a fiscal conservative, you love aquaculture because it's jobs and it's feeding. I mean, does all the things that appeal to you. And if you're left-leaning, you maybe want to get into it because it helps the environment and it keeps the wild fisheries are more easily managed and has less of an impact, negative impact on our food system, and it drives the cost of food down. I mean, wherever you stand, you know, aquaculture as an example is a good thing. So we decided to do this cookbook to be a complementary piece. 145 recipes created by Barton Seaver and myself, photographs by Eric Wolfinger. It's a marvelous, marvelous book. And it drops on October 28th. People can pre-order it. There's all kinds. Just go to andrewzimmern.com. The pop-ups are right there. I hope you'll have a link to it on your site. And the difference here with this book is that instead of just giving you 145 recipes and beautiful pictures, we also give you stories and information to help you be a better shopper and a better global citizen when it comes to how you eat and what you eat.
That's so fantastic, because I think I'm just going to say that most people don't want fish to go extinct, particularly like kinds that we like to eat. So I think that's amazing. But I also think that a lot of us, myself included, probably aren't as, you know, we know a little bit of this and that, but like when you were just talking about farm-raised stuff, like in my mind, I was like, oh, farm-raised is bad. So like, are there any, could you give us like a cheat sheet for, you know, whether you're buying food to cook at home or you're out in a restaurant, like things you can do to try to do it as responsibly as possible?
Sure. I've never heard anyone go into a supermarket and ask anyone who's working in the aisles or behind a case with where chicken may be on display, excuse me, can you point me to the wild chickens? Said no one ever. Okay. Aquaculture has, you know, amongst other things, was a dirty word for a long time because it wasn't really done very well. Science has now allowed aquaculture to do it very, very well. Right? That's number one. Wild fisheries have become increasingly well managed over the last 20 years. And you have several gatekeepers for the retail consumer. One of them are the people in the markets that sell seafood. The other one are chefs in restaurants that cook seafood. And you should ask questions. And they're really very simple. Is this fish from a sustainable and regenerative fishery? Now, if it's from an aquaculture system, the answer is yes. If it's from a well-managed wild fishery, like the Copper River Kings, okay? I'm just naming one that most people have heard that phrase.
Right, right. Right? Okay, yep.
Sort of the gold standard for, you know, wild king salmon, right? Then the answer is yes. And if they can't tell you, they'll go ask someone. A lot of servers may not know. Mm-hmm. Ask them to ask the kitchen. But if they can't tell you, don't eat it.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
You got to make a decision in your life. What are you going to support? I buy chickens that are raised under natural conditions. I buy eggs from farms where they raise laying chickens under natural conditions. And the reason that I do that is that a lot of the other labels are, you know, the term organic can be bought, right? The reason that I do that is because I'm voting with my wallet and my plate of who I choose to support, right? I don't want to support factory farms that raise chickens that are despoiling our environment and are treating the animals horrifically, right? So a lot of people believe that if you do all those things that I'm advocating, it makes things too expensive. Well, short term, and we're in this sort of phase where some is, some isn't. But as freezing technology keeps getting radically better, I saw some things at the Global Seafood Show last year in Boston that blew my mind when it came to whole salmon frozen so quickly that when defrosted and then filleted is indistinguishable from fresh. Indistinguishable. We also have supercomputers called phones that we carry with us, you know, OceanWise, Marine Stewardship Council, Monterey Bay Aquarium. I could keep going on and on. All these watchdog agencies have lists on their site of which seafood is red, meaning don't eat it, yellow, which is sometimes, and green, which is full send, go for it. Because depending on the time of year, and I mean, you know, we had 3 years where they weren't harvesting crabs, snow crabs, in off the coast of Alaska, right? Don't eat it. If you see it somewhere, don't eat it. We also teach you in the book, you know, easy methods of preparation. People, for some reason, are beholden to a lot of myths with seafood. It's too expensive. It's not. We go into that in the book. Is some seafood really expensive? Well, of course, right? But we don't advocate, you know, for putting truffles on lobster and having that as a weeknight dinner at the family table. So it's really important. The more you know, the better off you're going to be. And so we teach people everything from how to clean a shrimp, how to shuck an oyster, to what to do with some of the species of fish that are oftentimes cheaper, oftentimes smaller, whether it's grilling a small hold fish or poaching it or baking it. You're having a little bit of wisdom and a recipe that you can rely on allows you to shop smarter and shop with a better eye on your wallet.
I love that. So for people, for people who aren't so confident in their cooking abilities, I think that's another deterrent. Like, I don't know what to do with this fish. I'm going to overcook it. It's going to be gross. Give us a simple, like, no fail, like, anyone can do this and it's going to be awesome recipe. Go.
Well, there is a no fail recipe for which that Jacques Pepin taught me 40 years ago, one of my mentors. He literally, you know, took a piece of steak fish, I think it was swordfish, brushed it with olive oil and salt and pepper, and put the oven on 200 degrees and put the oiled piece of fish on a plate and put it in the oven. And while it was in the oven, he minced a whole bunch of vegetables, everything that he had on hand, onions, tomatoes, cucumbers, carrots, fennel, celery, minced it all, dressed it with some herbs, salt, pepper, olive oil, little squeeze of lemon juice, and let it sit. And after about an hour, hour and 10 minutes, he reached into the oven, pulled the fish out, poured this vegetable oil and lemon mixtures, beautiful, on top of it, and slid it over to me to eat. You just let the ambient temperature of the oven bring the fish up to an internal temperature sufficient to cook it. Right?
Yeah.
So people overcomplicate everything. You know, trying to tell people, I mean, it took Americans 20 years to learn how to cook a steak, and chefs misled everyone with the, you know, push down when you, a clenched fish is well done, a relaxed fist is rare to medium rare.
Right.
How about just using a kitchen thermometer? You'll learn really, really fast. I'm a real fan of teaching people how to put a hard sear on a piece of salmon, skin side down. Let it cook for 4 or 5 minutes, right? Still looks raw on the top. Flip it over and turn off the heat. And just let it sit there for another 5 minutes. And then plate it, crispy skin side up. By the time you get it to the plate, because the carryover heat from the pan and then the resting temperature, be perfect every single time.
Oh man, I don't know if the microphone is here. My stomach is actually like reacting to your descriptions of this food. I'm like so hungry. I'm like, it sounds amazing. Well, that the book sounds incredible on the two different levels of education and these amazing recipes. So I've already ordered it, Andrew.
Well, thank you.
So I'm very excited about it. Let's move into the speed round of this show, where I'm just going to ask you a couple of quick questions, whatever's on the top of your mind. So, you ready?
Go for it.
Okay, so what is a habit that you are grateful to have and one you wish you could ditch?
Oh, I have a horrible habit of being non-confrontational with my family.
Okay.
And it's not that I want to be confrontational.
Yeah.
With my family, it's just that that's the place to practice the most rigorous form of honesty.
Mm.
And I suck at it.
Okay.
I am very rigorously honest in other areas of my life.
Right.
And I wish I could match them.
Got it. What is one piece of advice you see out on social media that you wish everyone would ignore?
I see, I think 99% of social media is presenting people with an ideal of some kind that is a false prophet. Mm-hmm. There's how to make, my feed is just in, because I'm interested in tech and stuff, and the algorithm sends me a million things about how to make money overnight using AI and right. affiliate sales or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's just, it's appealing to our worst angels, mm-hmm. right? No one is giving away anything overnight that's going to make you rich.
It's true.
Nobody. Nobody is giving away anything overnight that is going to make you more beautiful, right? I hate to be a Hallmark card. People are already beautiful.
You'll get no argument from me. Well said, sir. Now, this is a heavy one. Popeye or Aquaman? Who's the better champion of the sea?
Oh, Aquaman.
Yeah. Quick one.
Also had better superpowers.
Right. So what's your go-to movie theater snack?
Oh, I'm a popcorn guy with one of those frozen slushy drinks.
Ah.
And it should be blue raspberry, but that's my common. When it comes to candy, it's Raisinets.
Now, are you a Raisinets in the popcorn kind
of guy? Absolutely not.
No, okay.
By the way, I don't want to yuck on anybody else's yum. But Raisinets in the popcorn is like an Instagram thing. It's a TikTok thing. A lot of that stuff doesn't taste good.
How do you feel about, for a minute, there was this trend of like making stuff on your counter, like counter nachos, where people just pour the stuff on their countertop instead of like in a bowl?
I love that.
You love that? Okay.
Well, historically, I do a polenta dish for my family. I do it on a cutting board, but you can do it on the counter if the counter is clean, right? and if you don't, the problem is you got to clean the counter, right?
Right.
I'd rather rinse the cutting board, right? But I make polenta. You spill it out on the cutting board. You sprinkle it with, you know, Reggiano Parmigiano, some fresh herbs, you know, some parsley, some basil. And then in the pot on the stove, you take the Italian sausage and the meatballs and the braciole and you place it around there and you ladle a few cups of tomato sauce that it's been simmering in for 2 hours on top of it. And you bring that into the dining room. Right. That's how polenta dishes like that have been served for 1,000 years or more in Italy. That's essentially serving something on a counter. I mean, it all has its roots.
Right.
Somewhere.
That sounds so good. And if you're feeding that to your family, I wonder if you will adopt me. Finally, there's a shelf of celebrity cookbooks in front of you. Whose are you reaching for when you want to make something fast and make something different?
Wow. I could list 20 people that a lot of you haven't heard of. Oh my gosh, what a great question. A lot of cookbooks these days I'm less crazy about because they're designed with things that I already sort of know how to do. I've spent my life in food, so it's hard to ask a chef that question. I typically reach for a Marcella Hazan book, a Julia Child book, a Jacques Pepin book, an Edna Lewis book, older classics, And then I see something and I think to myself, how can I take that recipe from the 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever it was, and bring it into 2025, right? Yeah. How would I reinterpret that? Would I break it apart and put it together again? Would I just do it as is? I use older books for inspiration. There was a best-selling Italian, award-winning Italian cookbook writer named Giuliano Bujali. I just recorded this for my Instagram a couple days ago. He taught Italian at my school when I was a young kid.
Oh, really?
And I could never figure out why the food he brought in to the school and share with people in his class, like whether it was cookies or you know, some cold dish or whatever, why it was so delicious. But it turns out he was teaching Italian at my school as he was writing books and doing all this other stuff.
Wow.
Well, Giuliano Bujali has written five or six of the greatest Italian cookbooks in history. Penelope Casas wrote five or six cookbooks on Spanish food during the 70s, 80s, and 90s. She's another one, right? Before food exploded and became commercialized, I like books written then because they wrote them as a way to document how historically things have been cooked. Then we can bring our modern sensibility into it. I'm flooded with cookbooks right now who are written by people who don't know how to cook. Seriously, they're TV talent or social media talent. Now look, there are people who are just on TV who are incredible culinarians. Incredible. You don't need to have a restaurant to be a great chef.
Okay.
Or write a great cookbook. However, we are flooded now. I mean, I've had publishers look me in the eye, and I'm lucky. I have millions and millions of followers in social who have told me that if you don't have at least 500,000 followers in each social platform, they don't even want to talk to you.
Huh.
Because all their marketing dollars are in the tank. They don't have money to market or sell books. So they're counting on authors and their fans to buy the books.
Yep.
It's a broken system. And we have people writing books based on fad. And it's just not my, it's not my thing.
Well, the book is called The Blue Food Cookbook, Delicious Recipes for a Sustainable Future. I believe by the time this episode comes out, it will be available for purchase. I've seen an advanced copy. It looks amazing. And as we said before, just the information is incredible. So thank you on behalf of planet Earth and behalf of my stomach. I'm very excited about
that. You're very welcome. And for anyone listening, just go to andrewzimmern.com for all things me. It's all there, right on the bar at the top. Everything that I do, subscribe to my Substack, buy my books, watch my shows, all that stuff.
And eat his foods.